So I think we did break the rules, but it wasn't intentional. It was just something that we wanted to have. You know, I didn't want to be part of that sea of plastic magazines.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the 150th episode of Media Voices. We're going to take this opportunity, 150th is a very special occasion, and we're going to take this opportunity to be the very first Media Focus podcast to throw our weight behind Yeezy 2020. That's right, we are the first media podcast that is really supporting Kanye West in his bid for presidency this year.
We are.
You're just a gold digger, Chris.
That's right. But yeah.
Yeah, what did
that? Well, anyway, 150th is a huge achievement. A huge amount of work has gone into it, and I just want to say I'm very proud of both of you.
And you.
I'm proud of you too, Chris.
Thank you.
The quote you heard hours ago was from Kathy Almedias, founder of the independent children's magazines Anorak and Dot. I had an amazing chat with Kathy about how she learned the collectability of magazines from her time at The Face, turned that into a style of publishing that owes more to books than her disposable magazine culture, and also how this time of COVID, she's found a new respect for digital media.
But ahead of that, though, we're going to do our standard news roundup. It may be the 150th, but our mission hasn't changed. So we're going to begin with this lead story. France is giving tax credits to news subscribers in an effort to rescue the sector. This one sent shockwaves throughout the media world. I remember seeing people on British media Twitter prick up their ears like prairie dogs, as though they suddenly like noticed a predator out there. So Esther, what had happened and why is this such a potentially big deal?
So, well, I can answer the first one. French MPs have, they've voted to grant a tax credit to anybody who takes out a new subscription. Tough luck if you've already got one. to a current affairs newspaper or magazine. And they've put some sort of specifics on this. It's up to £45 or €50 to households who subscribe for the first time. It has to be for at least 12 months. And it has to be like to a newspaper, magazine or online news providing, to an online news service providing news of a general or political character. The reasoning is because they say that the sector has suffered hugely because of coronavirus. It's not for any wider, greater good or anything. It's just like, oh, okay, the sector's suffering, so let's give them a tax break.
But isn't this exactly what we have been arguing for? It's just enough to tide the industry over. We're not looking for, you know, constant handouts. We're just looking for enough to make everything viable while we find a new direction and we find new revenue sources.
But the big question here is going to be if you're not already subscribing. So they've said quite specifically, if you're already subscribing, you're looking to renew, this doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't subscribed yet, is a tax break really going to tempt you?
I think ultimately it's going to come down to the same thing that tanked Civil. It's how easy is this process? That doesn't seem like enough of an incentive for me to do that, unless they communicate it in a way that says we are trying to save the news industry and this, look, we're giving you a free subscription effectively.
I mean, I think this is an interesting one, but there's a couple of things going on. The fact that they've focused it on news, you know, does that mean that other publishing sectors are not having a hard time? Well, clearly they are having a hard time. So there's something else going on here. There's a social engineering aspect about making people pay attention to news.
Well, this
Canadian
is the thing,
government's done a similar thing.
Canada is going to, well, it's thinking about raising the tax credit on digital news subscriptions from 15% to 50%, which is, I mean, that's specifically to encourage people to support media outlets. And you know what, in the UK, it's kind of interesting. We had the Cairncross review. And that was framed in terms of, you know, finding ways to give news providers enough time until they could develop their own digital news subscription products, you know, and make them viable. But this, to me, seems like quite a tangible way of doing that, at least in the short term.
I mean, it can't do any harm. It absolutely cannot do any harm.
And I think as well, I think the fact that they've rejected the proposal that if you're already subscribing, you're looking to renew, it doesn't count. Like, if you're already supporting the news industry, this is of no benefit to you. And that, I think, is quite sad.
The one thing that it does, and without getting all party political on this, it just absolutely highlights what a shit show British politics is.
Well, let's... You know,
what we got was a long talked about VAT reduction.
Someone typing?
Oh, yeah, sorry. No, I was looking at what the devil in the details is in French. Le diable était dans le détail.
Okay, that just sounds like the devil's
in the details.
All right, hear me out. Kanye launches a newspaper.
Yeah.
Musk bankrolls it. Industry saved.
I wouldn't want to read that, though.
All right, well, hey, do you... Peter, do you like to read the New York Times?
I actually am a New York Times subscriber.
Ah, that's interesting. And where do you tend to get that news? Is it, say, within Apple News?
Well, definitely not on Apple News and certainly not anymore.
So, yeah, the New York Times is opting out of Apple News to focus on building its own direct relationship with readers. So, Peter, why is it doing this?
So that it can build its own direct relationship with readers.
But what does that actually mean in practice? Why is Apple News a detriment?
Well, they talked to Apple, I guess, a lot about this in the past, as probably has every publisher on Apple News, and said, please, can we have more details about the people that are reading our stuff? Please, can we have a more direct relationship through the subscription process? And Apple said, nah. So the New York Times originally had scaled back. I guess it scaled back to about 4 stories a day or something. And then just this week said that, you know what, shove it, we're off. and they're the first major publisher to jump ship, to leave Apple News. And, you know, this is definitely not the death of Apple News.
Oh,
because
no.
There's not that many people in the world who can pull from Apple News and maybe not have a big, you know, it not have a big impact on their business, their traffic. New York Times is one of a few who can just say, we're going it alone.
That's, I mean, one of 3 or 4 who can probably do this and say, you know what, we might take a slight hit, but it's ultimately in service of streamlining our message and making sure that we have control over the context in which our content is published.
And those lists, you know, the actual people,
yeah.
The direct link with the people. I think the link between this story and the first story in France is that there are companies like the New York Times who can absolutely look after themselves.
Mm.
But there's a lot of people publishing news who can't.
So, yeah, the COO, Meredith Levien, told Nyman Lab, it's time to re-examine all our relationships with the big platforms. And what's, I think, interesting is that they have almost a boilerplate 3 questions, which they're going to apply now to all platforms. Esther, do you want to take us through these and see which one you think is kind of the most important to them?
Oh, gosh. I think, yeah, they're re-examining all their relationships. And they've said that for every platform they're on, what role does it play in the Times' audience funnel? Again, this is the end goal that they just want to drive subscriptions. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like the worst torture implement ever. The audience funnel.
God.
Sorry.
The second thing is, what role does it play in helping them scale direct relationships with people and forming habit and getting them to pay? Which, again, you know, good question. And then the third one is, well, what is the value equation? Because they say that, you know, platforms like Google, Facebook, Apple get substantial value from their investment in original journalism. So if there's not enough payback, then there's no point them essentially furnishing Apple with their great articles. So, yeah, I think the particular sticking point for them is that if they want to sell subscriptions, they just really can't do that on Apple News, whereas, you know, you can use Facebook as essentially a marketing vehicle.
Yeah.
But even if, I mean, you can actually buy a New York subscription through Apple News, but they take a 30% cut, and that to the NYT is just not, you know, that's not tempting enough.
No, yeah. It's not. Effectively, for what at this point as well, you know?
I would actually really, the Nyman Lab piece does a really good job of breaking down exactly like how they've worked out the value proposition and the calculations they've done. It's really, really good at saying, actually, Apple didn't add any benefit to them at all, so this is not a surprise.
I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but publishers should have been asking these three questions all along about the platforms.
Well, I think in part it was because the goalpost got moved.
The primary aim of Apple News was always that you could sell ads in it and, you know, keep your ad revenue and stuff, or Apple could sell ads for you. And it was essentially just like a marketing thing. And then they got the whole subscriptions push and then had to support subscriptions, and it just all got a bit of a mess.
Yeah.
But I think the question I've already got here, and yeah, it's one that the article raises, is that is this such a specific situation to the MIT that it was logical that they would eventually pull out? Or is this going to be one of those things that as more publishers put the subscription funnel front and centre, that actually they're going to look at Apple and have exactly the same conversation? I know that, you know, possibly the Wall Street Journal will be another one. There might be some others, but even if you're a smaller publisher and you want to retain that subscriptions, that direct relationship with yourself, then Apple is just not really attractive anymore.
Yeah.
Apple's trump card in this, though, is reach. Mm. I know we hate that word, but...
There is some debate about the 125 million number, though, because it's pre-installed.
Still, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's 100 million, 50 million, whatever. It's still more than most publishers have got on their own.
Yes, the all-important exposure.
It's an old conversation we've been having for years and years and years, but people still see that as part of the publishing equation.
Well, let's come. I'm going to set an alarm on my phone now. Okay, Google. Set an alarm for 6 months from now. NYT Apple. Well, we'll come back to that in 6 months and see what the impact has been.
Okay. My bet is that they won't be the only ones to have left at this point.
Yes.
I would agree with that.
All right. So moving on to Skift. Skift are, I suppose, a travel information and news site founded by, I would say at this point we have a long-standing relationship with Rafa Ali, the founder. And so they have decided to launch a daily news membership, which is designed to give travel industry readers unlimited access to news coverage and directly support Skift business and growth.
So they've decided to price this at what they've called a dollar a day.
Mm.
$365 for a year, which sounds like a lot, but then you think, oh, actually a dollar a day, that's not that much. Or you can get like a discount price for 2 years. Yeah, I think the timing of this is quite interesting. They have apparently had it in the works for about a year, and they were intending to launch it in February, and then coronavirus happened. They were like, oh, okay.
Ooh, that's interesting. They held back on launching a membership, whereas a lot of people have accelerated their plans.
Oh, but they had nothing to talk about.
That's true, actually. Yeah, travel
There's
is.
Nothing going on in travel. Yeah. Travel, well, sports.
They didn't, though. It actually ended up flipping the other way around. They had so much to talk about that they said that actually a lot of it, because the people that read them really needed that information. It's about what's happened, because they kept everybody up to date with, you know, what's happening with all the regulations, stuff like the US travel ban, when that's coming into place. And now they've said, actually, now we're looking at reopening. This is now vitally important information, and, you know, we need to ask our readers for payment for it.
I was going to say, because TTG in the UK, they had a flurry of stuff about, you know, regulations. They had a flurry of stuff about the impact it was going to have on travel businesses.
Yeah, but the people that would pay that subscription were making no money, zero money.
Okay.
So asking them for a subscription at the point that the travel company is making absolutely no money just was not going to fly.
All right, so they're still going to have 3 stories a month for free. They're continuing their free newsletter. The podcasts are going to remain open to access at any point. What I think is particularly of note here is that news has historically only been 1/3 of Skift's revenue model by design, along with business information and their events. Events obviously have taken a massive hit for everybody across the board lately. So I think it's relevant to Media Voices' audience that Rafa believes that the news section alone here is worth subscribing to.
We love Rafa, and the reason we love Rafa is because he's kind of been preaching what we, I think, subscribe to, which is a subscription-first business model and journalistic commitment, you know, wherever it is, he's journalistic commitment to the travel industry, but he believes in journalism.
He was preaching that way before the podcast launched.
A long time ago. So I think if that's at the heart of this, and again, this is what ties it into the previous stories in this opening, it's about looking after yourself, playing to your own strengths, and doing, and that's what Skift's done all along.
I've actually got a shameless plug for this. I spoke to Skift's chief product officer, Jason Clampett, late last week. So there'll be a piece out in Digital Content Next about the importance of reader revenue to Skift. That will, I think, hopefully whoever does the newsletter will put it in the newsletter, but that'll go in our daily newsletter. So you can sign up to that at voices.media to find out what Jason Clampett had to say about this.
And moving on now to news in brief, and this... It's hard to keep the energy up when you talk about this. So, Peter, what is going on with it?
So, Taylor Lawrence, who is brilliant, she's been writing about kind of the cutting edge of social for a long time. Well, a long time, a couple of years. She's now at the New York Times. She was in one of these audio chat rooms, which is exclusive to Silicon Valley venture capitalist types. And there was just this kind of weird pylon about how journalists have too much power and they cancel people and, you know, these poor little Silicon Valley millionaires and billionaires are really scared of Taylor Lorenz upsetting their freedoms to do whatever the f*** they want in their rapacious capitalistic bastard ways.
But this, hadn't this stemmed from something else earlier in the week? There was like, there were a couple of the VCs that were basically doing a massive pylon on her on Twitter.
Yeah.
And you know, and basically they're saying that journalists have got too much power.
Well, I saw one of them say that journalists shouldn't be able to write a negative story without the approval of the company they're writing it about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that's how journalism works, you prick.
Terrible. Google have appended plans by European media companies to block it from harvesting data about their readers. So we're taking this story from Reuters. Effectively, this is based around those whole like antitrust claims that have been made about Google. Effectively, this is...
Basically, they're saying they'll take the ball home.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't play by their rules.
Facebook is changing its algorithm to boost original reporting. And this is joining Google, who made a similar move a few months ago. But Facebook don't really have the infrastructure to do this. But anyway, it will demote stories in newsfeed that basically aren't transparent about who has written them.
Ben Shapiro.
Goodness knows how that's going to work, because they've not really got the tech to do it like Google do.
It's a SOP. And actually, I think it leads nicely onto our next story, which is...
This made me chuckle this week.
So you might remember, I think it was last week, we were talking about this vast industry-wide ad boycott of Facebook. You know, we had this whole discussion about the real reasons for this last week, but an internal meeting at the platform was leaked, where Zuckerberg was heard telling employees that, quote, my guess is that all these advertisers will be back on the platform soon enough, and that it's more of a reputational and partner issue than an economic one. And he's right.
I was going to say, he's fucking right.
He's 100% right.
He'll be back at the end of the month.
All it's going to take is for Facebook to do one thing, and it can be completely vague and nebulous, but as long as the optics are good, advertisers then can go, oh, you know what, they're changing. We want to reward the good behaviour by getting back on the platform.
And Times Radio launched this week with an exclusive Boris Johnson interview. Who either you listen to this?
How did they get that very, very softball interview with Boris Johnson?
He must just have huge respect for the platform.
That's it.
In its new venture.
There was a hilarious mix-up with this. So on Monday, when lots of people asked their Google Alexa, they said, play Times Radio. It played like a really obscure Ugandan radio station.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Probably got more sense off the Ugandan radio station than it did from Bojo.
100%. And finally, The Wall Street Journal has launched Noted, which is an Instagram-heavy news and culture magazine for 18 to 34-year-olds in an attempt to attract audiences to the journal.
18 to 34 is not a demographic.
Why didn't they just say they wanted to attract a younger audience? Why are they, I mean, like under 34, yeah, but...
Ideally, you want to have that Lego demographic, 12 to 99.
This week I spoke with Cathy Almadias from children's magazines Anorak and Dot. We spoke about making magazines that people keep and get sold on eBay, and about how Cathy thinks about success. But first, we spoke about where it all started.
I started Anorak back in 2006. I had become a mum in 2002, and I had worked in the 90s at magazines like The Face and Sears Nation. And I always had a very special relationship with magazines. Obviously, I helped make them, but also they kind of followed me around when I was a child. And it's when I became a mum, I always had a niche, you know, I just wanted to launch my own, but I couldn't figure out which one, what to do, which market. And it's really when I became a mum that the idea crystallized. I looked at the children's magazine market and just thought, okay, things have become quite polarized since I read magazines as a kid. So it was very much, you know, the blue army versus the pink army. most magazines tended to be really attached to some kind of brand or some cartoon or some entity of that sort. There didn't seem to be the sort of annuals that I used to read when I was a child, which were much more generic. And so I just thought, okay, let's give it a try. And, you know, I had contacts with distributors, I had contacts in the printing world, and I just thought, let's get started and see what happens. So, you know, beyond that, beyond the idea, there was no strategy behind it or anything like this. It was very much, the concept had to be that it was a happy magazine. It was general in its kind of, you know, it approached pop culture for children, and it was gender neutral, and that was it. That was literally what I wanted to do.
In that idea of being gender neutral, was that a difficult thing to do?
It really isn't. I think it depends on how you've been brought up, but it absolutely, it just came naturally, to be honest. And actually, when I launched it, I went to see a couple of distributors, and they're the ones who pointed out that the magazine was gender neutral, because at the time I hadn't realized it was. It just felt like a natural thing to do, because to me, culture shouldn't be gender-based. It absolutely should be completely gender-neutral, you know. So they pointed it out. They said, you know, oh, that's not going to work, because you have to approach girls differently from boys. And I was just completely gobsmacked, if I'm honest. I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Obviously, seen the kids' magazines over the years, and that idea that they're bagged up with different toys for different genders and whatever. And that actually does seem like a lot of work. And I guess in some ways you've got a much more simple approach.
Yes, definitely. Also, I don't have to think about what the toy should be.
Yeah.
And how, you know, how this toy is just like, it's crack, isn't it? That's all it is. It's just crack, is nothing else, because you just don't, children tend to just take them and then they discard it very, very quickly. Yeah. So, I mean, this was 13 years ago, and it's still sort of the same, although now obviously we have got, you know, us as an alternative, which is really nice, but it's still very much, if you look at the kind of mainstream magazine market, it's still very much based on those kind of values, which is gender. A commercial entity needs to drive it, whatever that is, whether it's cartoon character, whatever, as I said.
Yeah.
And then they have to be weekly and throwaway, you know, they're not very substantial.
Do you think the point with that is that the marketing is driving those magazines rather than the content?
Yes, exactly. I think that's what it is. It becomes very much a marketing tool for those big entities, but also they become very focus grouped as well, you know. They're very, people or brands will look at them and very specifically target content at a specific age and at a specific gender and at specific tastes, whereas we just took a much more laid back approach and just said, okay, well, we'll just do this magazine and see what happens.
When you talk about the magazines, Anorak and Dot, you talk about them being real, and they're not, that you've already said, not throwaway. What's so important about that kind of ethos, if you like?
Yes, I think already 13 years ago, as I had become a mum, well, actually a bit before that, but when I launched a magazine, I was already bemoaning the state of kind of throwaway culture or instant gratification culture, particularly when it came to magazines. They seem to just be these things that you have on a weekly basis and that you just use for maybe a day, a couple of hours, and that's it. And I mean, 13 years later, it's still pretty much the same, and it's actually probably worse, not so much magazines, but in terms of, you know, the culture being a throwaway things. So our role, I saw it as just bringing creativity, laughter, imagination, all this stuff that kind of, you know, defines childhood, and also a quiet space where kids can just, you know, have a really long time interacting with something. And for me, that's massively important from that kind of ethical point of view, but also from a responsibility as part of, you know, the rest of the world. I don't really want to be adding to the kind of wasteful consumerism that seems to be, you know, going on at the moment. So I think to me that to see that editions were done on nice paper that kids could colour in and they could go back to, and it's such a reward, and see that editions are passed on from one child to another, or they're sold on eBay, or people have said, I've given them to my nephew, or, you know, that's a massive reward to me. So, and also I think because we were quite naive, I actually, my inspiration wasn't so much magazines, it was probably books, to be honest. And I have a huge respect for our audience, and I saw Anorak as a kind of having the same intrinsic value as a book, which is something that you keep forever. And you have a really special relationship.
So when you see people selling them on eBay, that must be quite a buzz.
It's brilliant. Yeah, there's some of them that actually the early editions rake in like hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Somehow they seem to be in the same dollars.
I'd be trying to find a box somewhere in a loft and creating these little accounts that I can start selling them off on.
Go for it. I mean, they are 13 years old. You know, the first issue was launched 13 years ago, which is a lifetime away, I think, in magazine world. So
that was originally Anorak, but then you've launched Dot. What's Dot? What's the difference?
So Dot is kind of the same principle as Anorak, but it's for much younger children, because Anorak is very much for the 6+. And we launched it about, I think it's 5 years ago. And the reason I launched it is because a lot of parents, young parents, were saying, look, we love Anorak, but by the time our children reach the age of 5, it would have become vintage Anorak. And we'd really love to have something that's much younger. So that's how I launched Dot, really. But the principles are the same. You know, it's feeding kids imagination, but at preschooler's age. And you know, the same qualities in terms of the paper, the same qualities in terms of, you know, being something that you keep and that inspires children, that gets them laughing, that gets them creative, and that gets them using the imagination.
How do you distribute the magazines? Do you sell them in retail? Is it subscriptions?
So we sell them mostly online. We have obviously good retail shops all over the world, but our main revenue stream comes from the online shop, really. That would be about 80% of all our magazines are sold online and subscriptions, but also single editions.
And that's direct to you? You take care of that yourself?
Yes, which has been, you know, great during COVID at the moment. So with that, and also, you know, I harnessed the kind of powers of social media right earlier on. And I think that's the reason why we've become an online business, really. Because we use social media, and that instantly gives you an audience that's international. So, you know, that's why I think our business is pretty much, most of our sales come from online.
But you've never really put out a lot of digital content, have you?
Never.
So it's purely a distribution marketing vehicle for you. I remember you very early on. You would put little videos of you going to the printer, and you know, there was a real life to the social media presence that you had.
I mean, it's just, again, you know, I don't have a social media manager, I don't have a social media strategy. I love what I do. I feel very, you know, privileged to be doing what I'm doing, which is a dream fundamentally. You know, I have a lot of fun, and therefore I love to share what we do, and that's what I see social media as, is this tool to share what we do. Also, of course, it's a marketing tool, and it's asking people to buy the magazines, as bluntly as that. But also when it comes to other stuff, it's very much, here's, you know, what we do creatively, and all the things that inspire us, I just share it out. That's how I use my social media, which is kind of pure and very organic.
It's what marketing people now call authentic.
Yes.
Put a label on it.
Yeah, and they spend a lot of money trying to be authentic, whereas I'm just authentic without spending any money, you know.
Trying to fake authenticity. Yeah. So you also have Studio Anorak.
Yes.
Tell me about Studio Anorak. What's that about?
So it's kind of the commercial arm of Anorak, of the publishing house, if you like. So it's the studio, it's the creative studio. So it launched properly maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but throughout the last 13 years, we had brands that came to us and said, oh, we'd love to do a poster or some branding for a child event or some workshops or some magazines for children. Could you do these for us? And we've been extremely lucky that brands have come to us rather than us kind of, you know, pitching out and spending a lot of time doing that. So over the last really 2 to 3 years, we've been doing a lot of work with brands such as the Scouts, Airbnb, the ADHD Foundation, and it's all, again, taking the same principles of Anorak and Dot and just applying that to create pieces of communication for families that have the same values of imagination, laughter, and creativity. And we've just launched our website, actually, which showcases all the work, so you can have a look at that if you want.
And is that something that you want to grow?
I'd love to grow it, yes. I mean, you know, Anorak is very small, like we are in terms of resources. So it's fundamentally myself and then a designer, Ben, and a PR lady, Amy, and a bookkeeper, Jerry, who's amazing.
Need a bookkeeper.
Yeah, she's the queen, really, of all of this. And so, you know, I definitely would love to grow it, but it's a question of, you know, how we do that.
More generally, that idea of growth, I mean, it's tough when you're a small outfit in terms of balancing your ambition and what you can actually achieve. Does that bother you, or do you just deal with it?
I think I just take things as they come. You know, I'm grateful for everything that comes along. I've had to redefine how I define success, because when I first launched Anorak, it was always a side hustle. And then I went into a phase where I was chasing growth. You know, I was chasing clients, I was chasing more subscribers, I was chasing, etc. And I realized that actually, just for myself, it wasn't very healthy. And as soon as I kind of let go and redefined how I see success, which is fundamentally me being able to send out something that's joyful and that has a usefulness, because children, you know, can develop their creativity and be inspired, then that's how I define whether I'm successful or not. And I think we've definitely achieved that. And also we've kind of broken all the rules when it comes to publishing. And I know we're not the only ones, because obviously there's been a massive boom in independent publishing. But I think we've broken all the rules when it came to children's publishing. You know, the sort of, from an aesthetic point of view, from a distribution point of view, from a ethos point of view. And that makes me extremely proud. And that is definitely part of my kind of success criteria, if you like.
I think that idea of breaking the rules has become really interesting, because you've seen some of the newsstand, the major publishers picking up on that idea of magazines as books. You know, the luxury approach to production. So I think maybe it wasn't a bit breaking the rules, it was just a bit setting a new benchmark, maybe.
Yeah, maybe, or just, I mean, 13 years ago, that was not a concept at all. You know, magazines were throwaway. That said, you may have kept your collection of the face, like, which was a monthly thing. Of course you do collect it, because it reminds you of whatever moments in your life. But I think magazines were throwaway, generally speaking, 13 years ago. And now they are things that, you know, you just keep. So I think we did break the rules, but it wasn't intentional. It was just something that we wanted to have. You know, I didn't want to be part of that sea of plastic magazines.
Do you think working on magazines like Face and Sleaze Nation that people did keep, sort of, even if it was subconscious, do you think it sort of set you on your path?
Yes, absolutely, it did. I think the Face gave me the love for making magazines, because even though the Face was huge, the kind of teams were fairly small. I mean, bigger than Anorak team, but they were fairly small. So there was a real sense of family, of working, well, you worked for a family anyway, the Logans, and there was a real sense of craft as well. So I learned definitely that from there. And there was also a sense that, I mean, this was pre-internet, so there was a sense that you had a window onto other people doing the same things as you. So I think these have that kind of connection, which, you know, I think these have definitely fed into Anorak. I think with Sleaze Nation, I learned how to not do things. No, because Sleaze Nation was really small, and it was trying to, you know, take away at the face market a little bit, to chip at the face market. So it was, you know, it was really difficult, and I was a publishing director then. So I think it was a combination of me being new at this kind of role suddenly, but also learning, you know, that actually independent magazines don't sell that much. You have to fight a lot. So all of that really informed Anorak in some ways. But people also, as you, sorry, I've digressed a little bit, but yeah, as you say, people also kept those magazines. So to me, subconsciously, that Anorak had to be one of them that people kept too, whether on their coffee tables for 10 years or on their shelves for 10 years.
Is that one of the reasons you've never fully gone with digital content?
Yes. So I have to be completely frank with you. There was no plans to do any digital editions until COVID hit. You know, it was very much, I always championed real paper, you know, and the relationship away from the screen, really, a thing that you can do away from a screen. But if you don't adapt, you stay behind. And, you know, parents were asking me, like, basically what happened is the worldwide postal services have been slowing down for obvious reasons. There's limited air freight. So there was a practical thing, which is how do I send out to my overseas subscribers the latest edition? And of course, at first we did PDFs, and now we've actually got proper digital editions that we're distributing through Zinio. And that's the reason why we've done them. And they've gone down really well. And I think I had this kind of hang up about digital, if I'm honest, and maybe because I belong to a world pre-digital, you know, I grew up before a digital world. But I think actually when you have really good, I'm loathe to say content, but I guess the word is content. When you have really good things, it doesn't matter the medium. That's what I've learned, because children get a really good experience through our digital apps and digital editions as much as the paper editions. So, you know, parents have been very positive with that move. So I'm just like, okay, that's fine. We'll just do it.
Will you continue to do that after COVID?
Yes, absolutely. We'll just carry on with them. Of course, we're always pushing the paper editions, but yes, we are planning to have every edition from now on will be a digital edition as well as the paper.
So how else has the lockdown sort of impacted the work that you do?
I spend more time WhatsApping and typing on my computer rather than going to museums and do research days, but, you know, can't complain. And also, I mean, both magazines have done unbelievably well, which made me feel slightly conflicted at first, but I think parents recognise that Anorak and Dot are fun and also useful and are helping with creativity and escaping the kind of tyranny of homeschooling. Mm-hmm. So I feel really, really grateful to those parents, and it's done extremely well. We've also given away a lot of magazines to charities, which I have to be honest, I didn't do before COVID. And then we opened a Slack channel as well for illustrators to gather together every day. We just have a Slack channel where we just chat about anything. We have themes, we have guests. And that was definitely as a reaction to COVID, because I thought a lot of illustrators, even though they work from home, there's an isolation that is very different with COVID. So I just wanted to create a little community where we could just talk, and it's very much an escape island. We don't really talk about what's going on in the real world. We just talk about, you know, what we wear, how much we love pencils and pens, you know. Really, it's basically Anorak for grown-ups. It's been really fun. We've had guests that have come in to talk to us about, we had a child psychologist, we had a life coach talking to us about doubt and creativity. So, you know, it is Anorak for grown-ups, really, but it's been fun.
Do you think you'll keep these kind of things going?
Yes, absolutely. They've been really instrumental, and they've just opened my eyes, and, you know, definitely we will keep going. Of course, we're not going to meet every day at 4 o'clock like we've been doing on lockdown, because that's a little bit intense to keep up, so it's a bit more casual now. But actually, you know, yes, we still will log in, and we share things, and we still do that. And I hope to go back to museums at one point as well, although I've been really, you know, it's been brilliant. Like Google Arts have put a lot of museums online, which has been really great. So I can still browse through museums, you know, virtually, just to, you know, get inspired and stuff. So it's a different world, but it's a new world, and it's just, we have to adapt to that. There's been some amazing opportunities and changes through those terrible times that I think we need to hang on to. And I think also the outpouring of emotion has been, and you know, kind of generosity and love almost, without sounding like an old hippie, but you know, it's been really, really good. And I think we've kind of become a bit more humans again, which is really hopeful.
Our last question we ask everyone is for a recommendation that they can pass on to our listeners, a book, a magazine, articles, whatever. Something that you've really enjoyed.
So mine are not very kids focused, but they're things that have really inspired me as a grown up. So I saw the other day a documentary on BBC on iPlayer on Persian art, which is absolutely mind blowing. And I recommend everyone who is into art, but also misses travel, to have a look at it. I have laughed at a Twitter account called Pandemonium, which is really funny. And also Daisy May Cooper, who's an actress in the series This Country. She has an Instagram account that is absolutely hilarious. And then to educate myself, I have discovered the Black Curriculum, which is a really great association which wants to fundamentally change the curriculum to be more inclusive. So I'd recommend people having a look at that. It's theblackcurriculum.com. I tend to also look at a lot of Al Jazeera and read the news from there. They have an amazing program called Studio B Unscripted, where it's kind of casual discussion between two either activists or philosophers, and they're really thought-provoking, and I'd recommend people have a look at that. And that's kind of it, really.
So the three of us actually send a daily newsletter every day called the Media Roundup. In it, we include pretty much all the news we've spoken about this week, plus some analysis and some links to basically help you as a media professional do your job better. So if you want to sign up for that, you can go to voices.media and there'll be a nice little pop-up box. Or every day's edition actually gets posted to Twitter, so you can follow us there at Media Voices Pod to see a sample.
Hot off the press, every single morning.
And if you want to encourage us to keep going for another 150 episodes and to keep doing daily newsletters, then
Wembley 300.
Anyway, give us your money. If you go to our website, you can see the little pop-up button for Ko-fi. This week, we would like to thank contributors, the Pug Pig team, God love you. Mr. Neil Hanley from Texera Publishing, God love you. And friend of the podcast, Fergus Gregory at Collingwood. Thanks so much, guys. It really does mean a massive amount. Thank you.
You should see the excitement in our WhatsApp group every time we get a new one. It's great.
It's nuts.
We got a coffee!
Hey, well, if you're looking for more reasons to support us, why don't you go to our website, which is voices.media. There you'll find our entire back catalogue of episodes, many of which are effectively time capsules now, in addition to transcriptions and the link to the daily newsletter sign up. Additionally, you can find us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, so you can keep in contact with us and listen to what we're putting out into the ether every single minute of every single day. But until next week, when we'll be back with, I don't know, this felt like quite a cheery news roundup, but with another in-depth look at all the news and views in the media world that week. Thank you very much for listening, and stay safe.
Bye-bye.
Vote Kanye!